Hello and welcome to episode 66 of Epochs, and we are going to be talking about A Bridge Too Far. Well, you're going to be talking about it, and I'm going to be the naive questioner because I don't really know too much about it. I know about World War II more loosely, but not the specific operations, so I'm looking forward to actually learning some stuff.
Okay, I mean, this story is the story of the liberation of Holland. Mm-hmm. Nazi-occupied Holland in 1944. Me and Carl are doing a series on the monarchy, the English monarchy, but he's on holiday this week, so we've got to take a hiatus from that. But we are, people that are following that, we are going to continue doing that. But in the meantime, I wanted to do something a bit different, change of pace, where we've been doing sort of the Dark Ages for quite a while. I wanted to change it up, and I wanted to do something in World War II. I've got a handful of favourite things from World War II that I've read around for years on end. But one of them is Operation Market Garden, which is A Bridge Too Far. There's the film from the 70s, directed by the Lord Richard Attenborough. And I love that film. It's probably my favourite. It is my favourite World War II film. And the book by Cornelius Ryan, A Bridge Too Far, I've read multiple times. In fact, here's my battered copy of it, heavily thumbed copy of A Bridge Too Far. I thought, well, I can just sort of pick something else. I've wanted to do this for quite a while, so hopefully I can do it some justice. It'll be a multiple parter. We're not going to get through it all in mm-hmm. one go, because I wanted to do it in a fair bit of detail. Something a bit like a book club in a way. I'm going to quote from Ryan, from Cornelius Ryan, quite a lot, if that's okay. So, again, I've said in previous epochs, sometimes we do things at sort of a grand overview, whole generations, or maybe even hundreds of years in one episode. And sometimes it's sort of quite a tight thing, like we did the Nikkei riots, which is only a few days. So that's going to be one of these. I mean, the operation itself is in late September 1944, or the 17th of September to the 24th, 25th of September. So just 7-8 days there. I'm going to talk all about, as well, the war in late 44 mm-hmm. and the run-up to it, the planning phase and all that sort of thing. But the actual events themselves, is only about a week's worth of events. But as I say, I want to go through it in sort of really quite tight detail.
I always find it quite exciting to look at things in great detail, because you get, I think, relative to the time you invest in it, you get a lot more understanding of what actually went on when you go deeper rather than more broad. And I think that it's got more generalizability for the same amount of time, and it's far more applicable to lots of other things.
Mm. Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's just a different beast, really, when you have sort of an overview and you've got the grand sweep of events, or compared to when you talk about lots of individual people and individual conversations that happened, individual smaller decisions that were made and why. You don't really get any of that if you're just going to talk about, you know, two or three generations worth of time in 1 hour. So hopefully we can drill down into it. So one of the first things to say is that it's ultimately a failure. This isn't sort of a grand, brilliant, amazing thing that the British Army pulled off and it's glorious, you know, like an Agincourt story. It's not that. Thing is, it is mainly successful, but just not completely. And we'll obviously get into all of that. So what it is, in the grandest sense, at a certain point in World War, in 1944, the Allies, us, the Americans and the British, were sort of spoilt for choice of what to do. And Dwight D. Eisenhower, the Allied Supreme Commander, basically he was spoilt for choice of what to do. And he decides to go for this Operation Market Garden, which is A Bridge Too Far. So he decides to pull the trigger on that. And we'll get into all the details of exactly how that went down, why he chose to do that and all sorts of things. But that's sort of a grand overview of what it is. And go on.
Do you know some of the other options available to him? Do you agree with his choice that this was perhaps the best thing to do?
Well, in hindsight, no, because in hindsight you look at it mm-hmm. and you're like, that wasn't a good choice.
Okay.
But it's with hindsight. At the time... Mm-hmm. Who knows? I mean, at the time, it seemed like it would have seemed like quite a reasonable decision. Ballsy, mm-hmm. but still reasonable. But in hindsight, no, he should have let Patton around Metz and in the Saar region, he should have unleashed Patton and his tank divisions, the Third Army, to to punch into Germany.
A return blitzkrieg almost.
Well, that's it, yeah. George Patton out blitzkrieged the Germans at Blitzkrieg. Yeah, definitely. Also, one thing to say about Operation Market Garden is obviously in Holland, so it's in the north of the Western Front. Mm-hmm. And that whole sector was British controlled. So very, very broadly speaking, the sort of southern, central-most bit of the Western Front was controlled by Omar Bradley and George Patton, two American commanders. And the north was under Montgomery, Monty.
Of course, yeah.
Bernard Law Montgomery. So that was his... That was his theatre, really. And so where he pushed to have something done there, because he wanted all the glory, of course. He wanted to win the war. And in the end, Ike greenlit it. But I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here. If I could read a few lines from Cornelius Ryan's book. I need to say novel there. It's not a novel, because it's not fictional. Cornelius Ryan also wrote The Longest Day and The Last Battle. So he's known as one of the greatest World War II writers. But just as a little teaser right at the beginning of the book, he writes this. On the narrow corridor that would carry the armoured drive, there were five major bridges to take. They had to be seized intact by airborne assault. It was the fifth, the crucial bridge over the Lower Rhine at a place called Arnhem, 64 miles behind the German lines, that worried Lieutenant General Frederick Browning, Deputy Commander, 1st Allied Airborne Army. Pointing at the Arnhem Bridge on the map, he asked, "How long will it take the armour to reach us?" Field Marshal Montgomery replied briskly, "2 days." Still looking at the map, Browning answered, "We can hold it for 4. Then he added, "But sir, I think we might be going a bridge too far."
That's so, the name of the novel and film. That's funny, that.
That's from Major General Roy Urquhart's memoir. Some people say, who's played by Sean Connery in the film, Urquhart. Some say that might not have happened exactly like that. But nonetheless, that's gone down in sort of lore that Browning, General Boy Browning, the husband of Daphne du Maurier, incidentally, that he said, "We're going a bridge too far," because it's a perfect quote, again, in hindsight, because it was. Mm-hmm. It was definitely that. Okay, so just to tell you exactly what the idea was then, that this idea of sort of dropping a massive airborne army, 3 divisions, 2 American, the 101st, the 82nd, and a British airborne army.
So how many men exactly would that be in, say, 3 divisions? One thing that I've been thinking about this sort of plan.
It's just over 40,000.
Oh, wow.
40,000 troops.
So it's not exactly a small operation, is it?
No. It's the entire Allied airborne forces, almost, pretty much.
Okay. So it seems a little bit more reasonable now that they're going to take and hold 5 bridges for a couple of days, because I was going to say, if it was just, say, a couple of 100 guys holding off the Germans, well, they're not going to stand a chance holding 5 bridges. But 40,000, okay, well, there's at least a fighting chance there, isn't there?
Mm. To mention then is sort of the nature of paratroops, of airborne troops. Today, in our modern 21st century world, you don't really use paratroops very often. Hardly ever, really, because it's extraordinarily risky.
Isn't it, when they're parachuting down, well, they're very obvious. They've got a great big parachute above them. You can see the little dot in the sky. Well, it's just fish in a barrel.
Yeah, they're sitting ducks. Mm. Yeah. So sometimes it could work extremely well. If you do get the element of surprise, and that's really what it's all about, it can work amazingly. And if you don't, it can be a complete catastrophe. And so it's not really used anymore. It's sort of a moment in time, really.
When you think of paratroopers, you do think of World War II, though, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, so it was not used much before World War II either, because it was such a new thing, you know, the idea of men jumping out of aeroplanes with parachutes. It was used very well by the Nazis earlier in the war, a couple of times. And then one time they tried to use it and it was terrible. Their men sort of got slaughtered on Crete. They tried to use it on Crete I think it was Crete.
It's an unusual place to choose to do it, really, isn't it? I suppose it's a place where it's quite hilly, so they would ideally have lots of people stationed looking out over lots of Crete. So the element of surprise wouldn't really work there.
Mm.
And I mean, I see why they might have thought of it, because of course you drive up, you have an aquatic assault, well, that's going to be spotted just as easily, really, isn't it?
Mm.
So it's a difficult thing to assail.
Mm. Well, as you mentioned there, with sort of an amphibious assault or something, they usually would use it as just part of a bigger attack.
Mm-hmm.
So there'd be a ground attack or an amphibious assault or something, and paratroops used together is the idea.
That makes sense, yeah.
In the past, the Germans had used it, and it had been really sort of massively successful. And then one time on Crete, it was a complete disaster. And most of the military planners on the German side were like, okay, we're not going to do that again because it's too easy for it to go awry, really. However, the rest of the world, the Allies and things, did look at that and say, you know, if it's done well, though, if it's done right, it could be amazingly good. So in other words, on the Allied side, a lot of the planners still thought, you know, we could use this, we could try this one time. And so when we get to Operation Market Garden, they do it. And it's, like you say, like I said, over 40,000 troops, three divisions and more, because there's a Polish brigade as well, led by Gene Hackman in the movie. and it's way bigger than anything anyone's ever done before. Like I say, it's the biggest air assault, paratroop assault ever, up to this day, of course. And they were dropping in like jeeps, dropping in whole artillery pieces, howitzers. So yeah, it's quite incredible, really, what they did. And we'll get into all the detail of it. But so to give an overview of it, I'll read the whole foreword. It's only one page from Cornelius Ryans, but it's a few paragraphs here. If I can read the whole foreword, it will tell you what the deal is. So we'll keep calling it Operation Market Garden because there were two elements to it. Market, which is the airborne troops, and Garden, a armoured tank division rolling up from Belgium through Holland, hopefully to meet up with the paratroops in Arnhem, which is right in the north of Holland, near the on the Rhine, so on the border with Germany, really. And this is what Cornelius Ryan wrote. Shortly after 10 a.m. on Sunday, September the 17th, 1944, from airfields all over southern England, the greatest armada of troop-carrying aircraft ever assembled for a single operation took to the air. In this, the 263rd week of World War II, the Supreme Allied Commander, General Dwight David Eisenhower, unleashed Market Garden, one of the most daring and imaginative operations of the war. Surprisingly, Market Garden, a combined airborne and ground offensive, was inspired and carried through by one of the most cautious of all the Allied commanders, British Field Marshal Bernard Law Montgomery. Market, the airborne phase of the operation, was monumental. It involved almost 5,000 fighters, bombers, transports, and more than 2,500 gliders. That Sunday afternoon, at exactly 1:30 p.m., in an unprecedented daylight assault, an entire Allied airborne army, complete with vehicles and equipment, began dropping behind the German lines. The target for this bold and historic invasion from the sky, Nazi-occupied Holland. On the ground, poised along the Dutch-Belgian border, were the Garden forces, massed tank columns of the British Second Army. At 2:35 p.m, preceded by artillery and led by swarms of rocket-firing fighters, the tanks began to dash up the backbone of Holland along a strategic route the paratroopers were already fighting to capture and hold open. Montgomery's ambitious plan was designed to sprint the troops and tanks through Holland, springboard across the Rhine and into Germany itself. Operation Market Garden, Montgomery reasoned, was the lightning stroke needed to topple the Third Reich and effect the end of the war in 1944. End quote. And as we all know, the war didn't end until 45, April or early May 45.
Do you think the appeal of a plan like this, because it mentions in the foreword there that it's quite an original and daring plan, do you think that was part of the charm of it? Because the Nazis had dismissed large parachute regiments as dangerous and risky, and therefore they would probably assume that, well, they must have learnt the lessons of, from our escapades, and therefore they're not going to do this to us. And then the answer is that actually we do it on a level they never even thought of. So I think that the element of surprise there is very much something that Eisenhower would have been drawn to, I think.
Yeah, all those things you've said are right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all those things and more. Because, and we'll get into it a bit later, probably at the end, towards the end of this Epochs episode, but Ike and Monty didn't get on.
Well, I can already gather from the way in which it was kind of set up there that Montgomery was quite a cautious, quite a conservative with a small C commander.
Exactly.
And that doesn't exactly mesh well with this plan.
Mm. Yeah, no, absolutely. Everything you said there is absolutely right. For example, from the German side, when they realised what was happening, I'm getting ahead of myself. It will be probably the next epochs where we talk about the actual fighting. Von Rundstedt, Gert von Rundstedt, the German field marshal, and some others, Model, Field Marshal Model, just refused to believe that Monty had come up with it. It's because they all thought of him as the most cautious commander.
Mm-hmm.
Because also I was going to save this for a bit later, but I may as well say it now. Montgomery was famous, massively famous, the most famous general, certainly British, in the whole war by this point. His reputation was gigantic. He was the man that would save us. You know, Churchill was mm-hmm. the man in terms politically, but in terms of the army, in terms of military matters, it was Monty that would save us from the evil Nazis. Because earlier in the war, back in 41, 42, he had essentially won the North African campaign mm-hmm. against
That's
Rommel.
How I am familiar with him.
Right, and the North African campaign, just very, very broad strokes, Monty amassed overwhelming odds before he sort of pulled the trigger, so to speak. Like the culminating battle, the Second Battle of El Alamein, he'd massed just overwhelming numbers of troops and ammunition and materiel and all sorts of things. So that when the final battles happened, it was sort of no way we could lose almost.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was his reputation for
being... Well, that's an ideal situation for a general or a commander, isn't it?
Because the Desert Fox, Erwin Rommel, was sort of the opposite. He had to do everything on a shoestring, and he did his job amazingly good.
Yeah, I've heard like good things about his military strategy.
Yeah, lightning quick. You never knew where he was or what he was going to do next or where he would turn up next. And
well, when you're on the back foot, you want to do those sort of hit and run tactics, don't you? That makes perfect sense.
Exactly. But so the upshot of it all was that Montgomery had this reputation for being just the most cautious you could really be. And so some sort of giant or the biggest airborne invasion, 65 odd miles behind enemy lines, Monty wouldn't dream of doing something like that. No way, not in a million years. And yet they did. All those things. And exactly why Eisenhower decided to go with that, we'll get into. We'll get into it all. But so just to begin with then, just to try and set the scene for sort of what's going on in the war, certainly in the West, in sort of September 1944. So people might know, obviously, D-Day, early June 44. 6th of June 1944 is the day, D-Day. And so between then... And around the 3rd, the 4th of September, 1944, in that window of time, the Allies, so it's actually mainly the Americans, but also a heavy British contingent, but, you know, the bulk of the men and materiel is US. They'd done all sorts of things. They'd reconquered, or liberated, most of France, certainly nearly all of northern France. And by early September, by about the 3rd, 4th, certainly by the 8th, we'd liberated Belgium. We'd got Brussels. Mm. Brussels fell, I think, on the 3rd or the 4th. And then Antwerp, again, around about the same time, about the 3rd or the 4th. And we'd installed some sort of provisional Belgian government by the 8th. So that's where we were in that window of time. And again, Operation Market Garden kicks off on the 17th of September. So let's transport ourselves to early September 1944. The Allies and Ike have still got massive logistical headaches. So they're still bringing in pretty much nearly everything they need through Normandy, through the beachheads at Normandy. And so that's a bottleneck, a massive bottleneck, even though there's sort of temporary harbour there. I think I've seen historians say it was at the time the busiest port in the world. Just because
I can believe it.
Right, yeah.
It's not the best place to land. Well, it's not the best place to deliver goods. It's not necessarily a natural harbour.
No, right.
It's not ideal.
No, not at all. They picked it for landing craft, so men can get on the beaches. Mm-hmm. It's not a deep...
So it's actually the opposite of what you would want, ideally.
Yeah, yeah. So you've got big ships out to sea, and you have to sort of ferry things, everything, to the beaches and back.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a real bottleneck. It's a problem.
So now I'm starting to see the appeal of the Netherlands, because, of course, that's pretty good for... delivering goods, isn't it? Because there are actual ports there.
So Antwerp's the key thing. So from our side, from Eisenhower's mind, and the planners, they look at the map, and we'll put maps up in post so everyone can see exactly that Antwerp is key. He really, really, really needed to liberate Antwerp and to open it up as soon as humanly possible. Because that's a really good harbour. It's a deep water harbour. There's a massive, big, long estuary going up to Antwerp, and so that was sort of the key thing. So straight after D-Day, there were all sorts of various goals, military goals. Like one was to take the town of Caen. That was one, for example.
That's northern France, isn't it?
Yeah. That was one of the first ones. That's mm-hmm. I think on the day actually. They dropped some parachute troops into Caen, I believe. And so they've got a whole list of what to take and in what order. And so by this point, it's key that they get Antwerp. So we did do it. As I mentioned, that whole section of the front is sort of under British control. And so we did it. We did that. But there's a big blunder. There was a big blunder there, where we were able to take Antwerp really efficiently, really efficiently. The Germans didn't have time to blow up all sorts of things that they really should have, like sluice gates. And
what's a sluice gate?
Well, Holland is underwater. Well, it's not underwater. It's below sea level.
Yeah.
Sorry, the more accurate thing to say is it's below sea level. And so if they just allowed their dike systems and things to just run riot, then most of Holland would be under the sea right now.
That makes sense, because a sluice is something that removes water, isn't it? Or contains it or something like that. I'm familiar with the term,
right,
at least.
Right, yeah. So sluice, there's really important sluice gates that if they were... ever since the 11th century, the Dutch people have had an endless battle with the sea, with water flooding their land.
Yeah, their Antichrist is Poseidon.
So, just to cut the story of Antwerp short, because that's a whole thing. There's books written about that. There's people that are history nerds just about Antwerp. So anyway, we took that. But one of the biggest blunders, and it has been called by various historians one of the worst sort of strategic blunders of the war, was that we didn't close off that pocket, and tens of thousands of German troops... Tens and tens of thousands are able to escape north and eastwards. And we end up having to fight them still. So that was like a real strategic error.
Did that happen because the Allied forces were so focused on capturing the town that they allowed the Germans to escape? Is that more or less what happened, rather than prioritising capturing the Germans, which, I mean, they could have had their cake and ate it then as well? They could have captured them and had the town, and then that would have been fine.
Mm.
So it was a matter of focus, really, for the forces that led to that, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, well, they say it was that our troops, the Allied troops, were just utterly exhausted at that point, because you can only ask men to do so much.
Mm-hmm.
With the best will in the world, eventually men will just collapse. And they were just at the end of their tether, really.
Okay.
But still, that's the job of senior commanders to realise that that might be the case and have reserve troops ready. That's all the job of the planners. So it's not really an excuse. It is and it isn't an excuse, you know. Mm-hmm. It is a legit excuse. There's no way around it. That's just reality. That's just what reality is like. But make a contingency. That's the job of top brass. You know, that's the job of division, is to make sure that sort of thing doesn't happen. One historian called it, said it was, or historian called Little Hart, a British military historian, he said, it was a multiple lapse by four commanders from Montgomery onwards that we allowed so many Germans to escape from Antwerp. There you go. One of the greatest tactical mistakes of the war.
That's quite strong, isn't it?
Yeah, I feel that's too strong.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, it gives you an idea, doesn't it, of how bad that was. So, okay, so that's happened. We've liberated most of France, certainly all of northern France. The beachheads are absolutely unassailable now. We've got Antwerp, but Antwerp isn't sort of fully open and just... we're not just pumping in endless ships worth of materiel and men. So even though we've captured Antwerp, it's not doing its job yet. And so one of the things is you want to avoid any sort of stalling in momentum. Mm-hmm. But that's exactly what happened. We'd basically stalled. The momentum had sort of slowed down. And the Germans realised this as well.
Mm-hmm.
So are you just going to say something?
Well, it sounds like it was because all of the troops were exhausted. They needed some time to rest. That seems unavoidable considering the circumstances.
Yeah, because there are other elements around this time of the war. Sort of, there's the Battle of the Bulge. This is in the winter, a bit later. But there's the Battle of the Bulge and the actions around Bastogne. Have you seen Band of Brothers?
I have, yeah.
There's a whole episode about Bastogne, isn't there?
I remember it well.
In the forest, with
the snow.
When
we were talking about paratroopers, that was one of the first things that came to mind, actually, that series.
Right, yeah, they're airborne, aren't they?
Yeah.
Are they the 101st?
I think so. That would be what I would have said, so it must be.
Because the 101st are in this. The 82nd and the 101st Airborne Divisions are in this.
Gentlemen! This is a story that you will tell your grandchildren, and mightily bored they'll be. The plan is called Operation Market Garden. Market is the airborne element, and garden the ground forces. That's us. Now, this is our position on the Belgian border here. Tomorrow, three airborne divisions will begin landing in Holland. 35,000 men taking off from 24 airfields in troop-carrying planes or towed in gliders. The American 101st, here, around Eindhoven. The American 82nd, here, south of Nijmegen. And our own 1st Airborne Boys and a Polish brigade, here, at Arnhem. 64 miles behind enemy lines. Now, their job is to take and hold all the bridges in these three areas. Our job is to punch a hole through the German front line here and then drive like hell up this road, linking up with each airborne division on the way. Speed is the vital factor. The plan is to reach Eindhoven in 2 to 3 hours and Arnhem in 2 to 3 days. That, gentlemen, is the prize. The bridge over the Rhine. The last bridge between us and Germany. Kickoff will be at 14:35 hours tomorrow afternoon. The Irish Guards, under the command of Colonel Vandeleur, will take the lead.
Christ, not us again.
What do you say to that, Joe?
Oh, delighted, sir. Truly delighted.
I've selected you to lead us, not only because of your extraordinary fighting ability, but also because... in the unlikely event that the Germans ever get you, they will assume from your attire that they've captured a wretched peasant and immediately send you on your way.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.